Keep in step with the young Americans and one of their latest, Happiness. Monitor half hour, we investigate a legend, the legend of Billy Rose, who died just 2 years ago this month. His incredible accomplishments in several totally unrelated fields, his controversial personality, and his fantastic success drive all contribute to the overall profile of this self-made multimillionaire who was also one of the most flamboyant public personalities of all time. But that profile has two totally different sides. Billy Rose, genius or con man, entrepreneur or just shrewd opportunist, saint or scoundrel. Two books document the Jekyll and Hyde image of the man. First, The Nine Lives of Billy Rose, an intimate personal biography written by Mrs. Polly Rose Gottlieb, Billy's sister, who defines her famous brother to Monitor reporter Candy Jones.
Polly Rose Gottlieb, a rose is a rose is a rose, said Miss Stein, but what made this Billy such a special rose?
From the time I was a little girl, Mama always said, Billy is a genius.
Why?
Yes.
Why? What did he do?
He was so enormously bright. He always gave off sparks. From the time I was a little girl, whenever Billy came into a room, that room rocked.
Mm-hmm. Well, fame was an early companion of Billy Rose.
Yes, it was, because he became the national champion when he was in shorthand, trained by Mr. Gregg himself. That was the beginning of the system, when he was in his teens.
I think you said in the book 15.
Correct.
Was his first
Correct.
Title.
Correct.
But he didn't finish high school.
No, no. And Billy, trained by Mr. Gregg, was sent around to all the high schools, and he used him as a model and would pay him $25 an hour. Now, that's an awful lot, you know, for a little kid. And Billy became the provider of the family.
Well, his first job was what, after Mr. Gregg?
After Mr. Gregg, Billy went to Washington. He had found out that Bernard Baruch, who was then chairman of the War Industries Board, needed a secretary. And Billy said, that's for me.
And just like that, he
picked
up... Just
like that, he went to him. There were many, many rooms. Let's say it was something similar to our Pentagon. But no system of communication.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knew what was happening in the other rooms. You know, Billy went to Mr. Baruch, handed him a typed out, meticulously drawn paper, and said, do you want to know everything that's going on in every room and have every bit of that knowledge at your fingertips every morning? And Mr. Baruch said, it can't be done. Billy said, yes, it can. But you have to fire every slob who's working here.
Slob, you said?
Slob. That's what he said.
That was
not
Billy's
what I said.
Vocabulary.
That was Billy. You know, Billy spoke in a vernacular.
Right.
When he said it, he meant it, you
mm-hmm.
know. And Mr. Baruch said he was listening. And Billy said, you've got to hire all my buddies. He said, I'm top dog, and I know everybody else
mm-hmm.
who's a great writer and a fast writer. He had him buy new typewriters, dictaphones. And as Billy promised, Mr. Baruch had all the facts at his fingertips every morning. That was the beginning of the 47-year-old friendship.
And that was the first of the 9 lives of Billy Rose.
You're so right.
What were the other 8 fields? I know that he had been a songwriter. What are some of the songs that Billy had written? Barney Google comes to mind.
Actually, it's a very interesting thing that Billy wrote, according to the ASCAP records, over 500 songs. 108 of these, he wrote the lyrics solo, by himself. He had so much energy and so much talent. Every writer he ever worked with just adored him, but said, get this guy off my back. He doesn't let me rest for a minute.
Well, that's career number 2.
Rainbow Around My Shoulder, yeah. It's Only a Paper Moon, That Old Gang of Mine. He has 33 standards in ASCAP.
And
Still being played. And I would say that for all time, with songs repeating the way they are now, there's like a minimum income for all time to the estate of around $70,000 a year.
Every year?
Every year.
Oh. No wonder he was a multi-millionaire, and his state
will
always be that way.
Well, that's a small part of it, but it's a nice little income.
Yes. Career 3 was as a showman.
Correct.
Carmen Jones, Jumbo, Crazy Quilt.
And the Aquacade.
Ah, he invented the Aquacade.
He invented the Aquacade.
Well, there I'd call him a producer and call that career 4.
Yes, because that opened up the whole field of the most spectacular show.
I recall reading in your book where he was making $30,000 a day from the gate for nearly 2 years out at the World's Fair number 1.
Well, I'll tell you something. I was being very conservative in the book.
How
impressive can you get?
Well, let's impress them a bit more, because as a nightclub producer and operator, career number 5, you had stated that he had a net of $1,000 a night for more than a decade.
Correct.
In the Diamond Horseshoe.
Correct.
What about his column?
Oh, that was wonderful. And, you know, there again, the Whammy Contingent, or as Norman Katkoff named it, the Belt Billy Club. You know, hitting Billy, he was so successful, it became a sport.
Well, there isn't any fun hitting someone who isn't someone, so that naturally they went after the tallest target.
Yeah, and look, let's face it, Billy was no angel. This was a rough, tough man. This was as tough a man as you could meet. This was a man, the only man, who out-toughed the mobsters and did not wind up in a concrete kimono.
Or with a broken nose.
That's right.
Well,
I must say on that, we won't go into his run-in with the mobsters right here, but Billy's life was saved with a big bow and a thank you, primarily to Walter Winchell, who was his best buddy at the time,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Baruch, and through these two wonderful friends, J. Edgar Hoover was reached. That's how Billy became sort of a pet of the mafia, because they respected for the rest of his life this tough guy who stood up to them and got away with it.
And they didn't dare touch them with Winchell.
No.
And
no.
J. Edgar Hoover.
That's
and Baruch,
right.
Of course.
That's right.
Polly, before we go down to career number 6 or 7, as his sister, what was it about Billy that made people dislike him? I know that You had just said he wasn't an angel, but what would you have tagged? Why did he rub people the wrong way?
He did. He rubbed an awful lot of people the wrong way. Billy couldn't stand stupidity. If somebody was stupid, he would just say it. You're stupid and get out of my sight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was that simple.
In other words, he did run a one-man show, and if you couldn't keep up with Billy Rose...
Billy was a complete loner.
Mm-hmm.
Billy was a loner.
Was he happy as a man with nearly $50 million?
Billy had 10 great years, for which I will be eternally grateful to Eleanor Holmes. Those were the happy years of his life.
Let's get back to the end of the nine lives. I think we're down to about number six. He was a Wall Street tycoon, too.
Yes. Well, see, it was while he was married to Eleanor, that's after he made his first $5 million, that Billy really took his position. It was through 1946 and 1948 that he took his big position in American Telephone.
Mm-hmm.
That's when he bought his stocks.
But with all this money, was he a man who would give his money away just to people, or was he thrifty?
No.
I've heard
Billy wasn't thrifty. Wait a minute. He was parsimonious.
Ah.
Ah. But thrifty, he lived like a king.
He lived like a king?
He lived like a king. He kept six servants all year round in Jamaica.
Uh-huh.
You know, 7-acre home.
But I heard
rooms.
He wouldn't even buy his own cigarettes, and he was always sponging sodas.
No, that's not true. No, I explained that from the time we were children. My mother used to say, when you find out the neighbors are cooking a good meal, go knock on the door. Sit at the table. They'll feed you. Now, coming from somebody else, that would be a callous and horrible thing to say. For my mother, it was a very practical suggestion.
Mm.
And it kind of kept us eating. And, you know, Billy learned to catch things when he was a little boy and just sort of continued. He'd come over and say, you got a little bit of soda left?
Aw. I have to also add that Billy Rose was an art collector, and, of course, he was a philanthropist. He had given his magnificent sculpture, the art sculpture, to Israel and the art gardens in Jerusalem.
Correct. He had Noguchi design the Billy Rose Art Garden, and he paid for it, and that was close to another $1 million.
There was one thing, though, I did want to add. In his room, Billy Rose slept in the bed of another short, very aggressive
man. Napoleon Bonaparte. Now, this is interesting about Billy, who always had a sense of the gigantic, which he got from my mother. Billy always slept in a tiny bed, a small bed,
mm-hmm.
but I really mean narrow, like a 30-inch wide bed.
But in this case, it was Napoleon Bonaparte's
Correct.
Original bed.
It was his field bed.
His desk was the original desk of Jonathan Swift.
Correct, on which he wrote Gulliver's Travels.
And in those top desk drawers, he had, tell about that, you must tell.
Yes, in the drawers, whenever he would break a packet of $100 bills, he would stick the $100 bills in the left drawer, smaller denominations in other drawers, and across the top of the table, he would have glasses with dimes, pennies, nickels. And when I'd say to him, Billy, what goes on? Why do you keep loot like that hanging around? He said, Polly, all I ever believe is the 50 cents in my pocket.
And that sums up Billy Rose. Thank you so much for being with us today. We've been speaking with Polly Rose Gottlieb, whose book about her famous multimillionaire brother, the late Billy Rose, tells frankly, affectionately, and so very honestly of the nine lives of Billy Rose. This is Candy Jones for Monitor.
2 minutes away, another author with a totally different definition of the real Billy Rose. You're pounding down the highway at the legal limit. At first it's fun. Then it's routine. Finally, it's monotonous. And that's when the driving drowsies strike. Don't take extra chances. Pull over and fight back with No-Doze. No-Doze has the strongest stimulant you can buy without a prescription, and it's not habit-forming. No-Doze. No car should be without it. Part two of the Billy Rose legend is next, so stay on the Monitor Beacon.
Monitor, New York. WNBC, New York.
Way back when Nero fiddled while Rome burned, the fastest way to get around was by horse. with or without chariot. We've added a lot of horsepower since then, but we still haven't solved the problem of traffic accidents. People who drive a lot, like professional truck drivers, avoid them by driving ahead of themselves. They look far enough ahead to see trouble in time to react safely. Try driving ahead of yourself.
This is Big Wilson. Remember, measure for measure, you get more. Mornings on WNBC. As the WNBC news staff and I keep you informed of what's happening with interviews and phone calls to the nation's newsmakers, you keep me informed of your opinion by calling on Plaza 78866. Mornings from 6 to 9. We act on and you react to the news in a bigger way on WNBC.
At 21 minutes after the Monitor Hour, we delve a bit deeper into the controversial legacy of Billy Rose, the late multimillionaire who enjoyed success in several major fields. Author Earl Conrad's new book, Billy Rose, Manhattan Primitive, paints an entirely different picture of the man and the legend from that offered a few minutes earlier on Monitor by Mr. Rose's sister. He revealed what his research uncovered when he talked with Monitor reporter Bob Lazich.
Mr. Conrad, in your book, Billy Rose, Manhattan Primitive, he comes off as an absolute scoundrel. Had you ever met Billy Rose?
No, I never met the fellow. No, I never did meet him. Tell you the truth, I'm a little bit upset to hear that because I don't feel that he was exactly a scoundrel. And my publishers put a cover line on the book called Incredible Story of a Broadway Scoundrel. I was a little surprised when I saw it, but maybe that's the way the book comes out to others who read it. I just wanted to do a very objective, true account of the real Billy Rose and sort of extrapolate him from the great public relations game that had been built up around him for 40 years.
What were some of the careers that Billy Rose had? He started out as a man who could take shorthand like a whiz.
Yes, that's true. Well, if you ask me, and my position about him is that he had, like you and myself, one career. Everybody has one career. Only you, even a cat doesn't have nine lives. He had one career in finance, and all of his moves away from finance were variations on the same theme. And so he had one career of that of making money, and he didn't care where or how he made it, and he made a great deal of it back in the speakeasy days, running his early nightclubs. And that he made money off of songs, and he made it in the theater, and he made it on the stock market, he made it in a restaurant, he made it off of a column. But it was all one career, one long career of money-making.
In funneling into this one career of making money, did he really have a talent for all of these other things that contributed to his fortune, such as writing songs?
In my opinion, and in the opinion of most people who know him, no essential creative talent. It's best illustrated by the statement made to me by a very good writer, Maurice Zolotov, who did the biography of Marilyn Monroe, and the biographies of about 10 other leading theatrical people. He spent a year and a half with Billy, 3 or 4 hours every day, doing Billy's biography back in 1946. Zolotov told me, and this is just recently, he said, I saw nothing creative in this man. He was a good money maker. He saw nothing creative, and that was a close-up. Now, this same thing has been told to me by everybody around him, that he could work with all kinds of artists, and he had to work with them. Songwriters, writers. In particular, he liked writers, and writers played a large part in his life. They made him as famous as he became. And he could he had a great faculty with words. He had a language. He could edit very well. He could even edit these songs into existence by working with the songwriters. He could collaborate. But all the songwriters told me that he couldn't conceive one of these songs alone by himself, that he had to have help. But Billy could organize. He was a promoter, greatest promoter perhaps in history. A salesman, these were his gifts, the gifts of a businessman. And whether he made money off of Carmen Jones or off of peanuts, it was all the same to him. In fact, he made more money off of popcorn and peanuts than anybody in America.
Did anybody ever get close to him?
Well, that's a pretty good question. Yes, I would say lots of people got close enough to him to make, you might say, a very careful study of the man to know him very well. He had some friends who knew him for 30 or 35 years. The fault lay with Billy. He couldn't extend himself. He couldn't, as Ben Hecht told him, another writer named Charles Samuels. He said, Billy can't love anybody. That's his problem. Billy can't love. People could get close to him, and he was afraid to deal with them. He was afraid perhaps they'd take advantage of him. He didn't want to be soft. He used to say, like many producers say, in this business, the business of theater production, kindness can kill you. He lived by a kind of credo like this. Well, a man like this is a kind of a loner. One of my informants was a man named Irving Hoffman, a man who knows the backstage of New York for the last 40 or 50 years, himself a former columnist. And he said that in the Billy's declining days, Billy would walk from his home up in the East 93rd Street. He'd take a walk downtown, or he'd come down by cab, and he'd go into Sardi's, and he'd sit there alone late at night, looking rather ghastly under a pale light, reading the morning paper, nobody sitting at his table, waiting for somebody to come in and talk with him. This was in his declining months and year or two.
What do you think contributed to the makeup of Billy Rose that he had such a lust for money?
Well, of course, he had origins of great deprivation in the ghetto of New York City. And he had a family background of most considerable poverty. Food would be scarce for him. His father wasn't much of a breadwinner. Billy just came up in these congested environments of lower New York. And also, he had some bad experiences. He was pushed around quite a lot by bigger boys. He was a diminutive fellow, rather small. But he had a lot of physical aptitudes in spite of, or because of, the fact that he was small. He could run. Then he won some citywide championships. He had great skill with his hands, as is attested by his capacity with shorthand.
He's a pool shark, too.
He was a pool shark, right. He was a great pool shark. So he had a lot of physical aptitudes. And then he had one thing that intrigued me throughout my study of him and trying to figure out what made Billy run. I think that he had about the concentrated energy of three heavyweight championship fighters packed into his small body. His secret was enormous energy.
In your search for information for this book, did you have any trouble finding somebody who would say something good about him?
You know, that was one of my biggest problems. I did find a few people, but I had many people who gave me information about Billy, and they put it this way. They said, if you don't find some people who have some good things to say about Billy, you're going to have trouble with your book. So I really went on a quest for people who had pleasant things to say about him, and I did find quite a few. They turned out almost invariably to be people who didn't know him very well. There was a woman who's an advertising woman or a public relations woman in New York, Gloria Saffer. She's mentioned in my book. And she only worked for about a year and a half when she was 18 or 19, but she thought he was a genius and the greatest promotion man in the business. And then finally she wound up saying, but I'm one of the very few who think this.
When he died, wasn't he the largest stockholder in AT&T?
Not exactly. I thought he was. I read all about that in the papers, but I wrote to the president of AT&T, and I was told of another man who had about twice as much stock, and it's somewhere in my book, and the name skips me, I think, somebody else. And I also heard that Tommy Manville was one of the largest stockholders and had a larger holding in that. But Billy and his press agents got the word around very widely that he was the largest stockholder. But as I say, I got the information right out of the horse's mouth that he wasn't.
Thank you very much, Earl Conrad, author of the book Billy Rose, Manhattan Primitive. Now this is Bob Lazich in San Francisco, returning you to Monitor.
Two diametrically opposite points of view on Billy Rose, a man who was a legend in his own time and whose career still makes fascinating reading and listening a full 2 years after his death. Monitor spanning the continent on NBC Radio. Down in Jacksonville, Florida, folks hear us on WJAX. Monitor returns shortly with The World in Washington, produced by NBC News. This is Brad Crandall.
This is Chet Huntley. Barbara Walters, Bill Cullen, and I come your way each weekday with emphasis on NBC Radio.